So I will start at the beginning. Back in 1975, I was carrying my third child, and I was 6 months pregnant. And I was owned and operated a farm. You know what farmers do? They go out and they tend to their harvest in October. And that's what I was doing. Had a lot of pain in my right leg. I ended up, the next day I had a doctor's appointment. My leg was swollen. He took one look, called a couple of colleagues in. Make long story short, they put me in the hospital right then. I had thrombophlebitis. They wouldn't let me out of bed. They wouldn't even let me put my legs down over the side. And that's where I was for a little over a week. They were pumping heparin into me and taking tests and, you know, things like that, and my blood wasn't thinning. And one morning, I woke up, and I wasn't feeling very well, and they brought breakfast, and I kind of didn't eat very much of that, and it just didn't work. And feeling really sick, I was in pain, and it was kind of non-localized. It got more and more miserable, and the next thing I knew, I came out of my body. And I was hanging up in the corner, and I was like this little spirit. It wasn't like, okay, this is new. It was whatever contained me had always been there. So I'm looking down on my body. Pain was gone. While I was up there, and it's very difficult. I've got to tell you right now, it's very difficult for me to hold this in a linear fashion in the 1-2-3 order because everything seems to run together, but it doesn't run together. It's just you have to be in a, I have to be in a different mind frame to do that. But while I was up there, the two things happened. One, the diet aide brought my lunch in, said, your lunch is here. And I'm sitting up there thinking I should go down and eat it. I should go down and eat my lunch. And I don't want to go down there. But I was, you know, used to doing what people expected of me. And as I would turn my attention to the part of me that was laying in that bed, that vehicle, I would start to feel the pain again. I would start to feel ill. If I didn't think about it, I felt fine. I felt wonderful, and I felt very alive. As I'm sitting up there, and I'm thinking, I was thinking about my children, and I hadn't seen my children in over a week. Back then, your children and maternity wards just did not go together. I was thinking about my four-year-old. I hadn't seen him for all that time, and he was ill when they put me in the hospital. You know how it is to be a parent. You know, your heart just kind of pulls you toward the child. And that's what happened. I was out of there, and the next thing it wasn't like traveling, it was like the thought took me. The next thing I knew, I was in Aunt Pearl's parlor, and I was just hanging up over the buffet there, and she was rocking my son, and she was singing to him. She had a beautiful voice. He was just bereft. I could feel his feelings. I could feel the hurt in him. I could feel him missing me. I went down and I just surrounded him with my essence, with my love. He started to quiet down, but he was wanting his mother's touch, and he started to dream, and I could see and feel his dream. And he was dreaming that it was me holding him and rocking him and singing to him. As I felt him being comforted, my thoughts went more to my other son, who was 11 years old at that time. And I was drawn to him, and he was in school. He was actually in the classroom. He was sitting there, and I could feel his confusion. I could feel his upset. He was missing me, but it was different. You know, he knew where I was, but his heart was still missing me. But he knew I was in the hospital. He didn't feel abandoned. There wasn't that abandonment that the little one felt. I went down and I flowed around him, and I was trying to comfort him, and my younger son recognized me. My older son did not, but he became peaceful and comforted. And, you know, I liken that to the fact that he was more involved with the world. He was more involved with the intellectual than the four-year-old was. And then I was drawn back to the hospital room. I think it was about that time that the diet aide came in and took my lunch away. She didn't ask if I wanted it. I was laying in bed. I was curled up in a fetal position, facing in the other direction, facing the window. And she didn't ask if I wanted that food. She didn't check to see if I had eaten it. Nothing. I could feel this not caringness, total disconnect from what she was doing. She carried a tray in, she carried a tray out, had nothing to do with taking care of anyone. I just felt so terrible. I felt terrible. I felt bad for all of humanity, and I felt despair, really, for every person who is treated like a non-person. I think it's really important. I don't like this next little bit, but I think it's important that I tell you. Right on the heels of that feeling came the feeling of and the remembrance of the times that I had not cared or not thought about what I was doing or whether I was treating a person, people like a person or maybe a non-person, maybe they felt like a non-person, whether I knew it or not. So I felt that, you know, first there was a judgment, and then there was that feeling of judging my own actions, right, with the, that same sentiment. And as I sat up on the, up there in the corner, I'm up in the corner doing my little corner thing. And so I'm hanging up there, sitting up there, looking down and looking at that body, and it's looking uglier and uglier. Let me tell you, it was terrible. It looked like spoiled bread dough. Yeah, you ever make bread and forget about it? On the farm, you know, we get busy. We get our bread done at 4 in the morning, and then we get busy with other things, and then the calf starts, you know, the cow starts calving, and, you know, and there's all these things that you don't get back to, and the next morning you find it, and it's spoiled because the yeast, there was nothing for the yeast to feed on anymore. Well, that's what my body looked like to me. It was like this body made of spoiled bread dough. And I was feeling despair for humanity. I was feeling not wanting to be a part of humanity anymore. As I'm doing that, I started to absorb knowledge from the field around me. I don't know. All I knew is I started to understand what trials were about. I started to understand what the trials that my children would have in life were about. I still wanted less and less to do with humanity, but in that understanding, I didn't feel like I was abandoning my children, because at that point where I made that decision that I wanted nothing more to do with humanity, I don't know if you want to call them angels or guides, whatever. They're just my guys. They've been there for a long time, all my life probably. And they communicated to me, are you ready to leave? And it was this thing of, is this your final decision kind of thing, you know? And I was like, yes, I'm out of here. I am done. And that nanosecond, I was in the light, and I was in a new body. The biggest surprise was the new body. And I'm like, you didn't tell me about this. Nobody told me about this. Nobody told me there were bodies on the other side. This is all new to me. And they communicated to me that that body that I now was in was the body that I had built while I was here with my actions. It was glorious. It was wonderful. I was just, you know, the first time I wrote about this, I had pages, and Norma and Marge, they said, do you know what this looks like? You can't write this in a book. You know, you can't have 2 pages of jumping up and down and letters this high. I said, but that's what it was like. I don't know how to tell you how I traveled, because I think I traveled on a thought. I was in the light, and then I was in this glorious place. It had mountains and streams and meadows and flowers, and it was incredible. I am standing, and I can feel the grass under my feet, and I can feel the air around me. And those mountains were colors that I had never seen, and the grass and the flowers and the colors. There were colors that I can't even begin to imagine with my finite mind. The flowers and everything there, it was like I could see into them. And it wasn't as if they were transparent. It wasn't as if they were a ghost-like thing. It was as if they cared so much for me that they wanted to share everything that they were with me. And the colors were separate too. The colors on their own were sentient. It was like you have a flower and the color gave of itself to the flower. It was the most incredible thing. That's the only way I can describe it. And they were communicating with me and communing with me. You know, I was in, you want to talk about being in seventh heaven, I'm not sure there's numbers to count to the heaven I was in. And there's my father you know, the person that I missed the most in my life at that point in time was my dad. Daddy and I had been very close. We had farmed together. Saturdays we went off to auctions. You know, in the East we have farm sales, and there's an auctioneer, you know. That was our Saturday recreation if we had time, Saturday mornings. I was just so happy to see him. I just ran into his arms. I don't know that run is the right word, but it was like my love pulled me because I don't remember my feet moving. We embraced. He loved his farm. He loved that farm, and I loved that farm, so I understood. He didn't want to die anywhere else but that farm, but he was choking the last day of his life, and I took him to the hospital. I didn't want him to choke to death at home. I just was heartbroken. He died 23 hours after I took him to the hospital. And I was heartbroken about that and the fact that I had taken him to the hospital and that I hadn't found a way to manage that. We communed about that, and he told me how thankful he was that I had kept him at home all those months, and he had been there with his grandchildren. He had been there with his family, and he hadn't been put in the hospital and hooked up to tubes and things, which he never wanted. So there was this wonderful feeling of forgiveness, and it was in that forgiveness that we had this complete reunion. And then he told me something else that I really didn't want to hear. He told me I needed to go back. I couldn't understand that. Here I am. I'm happy. I'm with my dad, and this is my, you know, and this wonderful place, and he's saying, you need to go back. But each time that he relayed that to me, it wasn't like he was saying, I'm telling you to go back. He was saying, you want to go back. That was the feeling he was conveying to me, that I wanted to go back. And I knew I did not want to go back. And I'm telling him, you know, that's a terrible place, Daddy. People hurt each other. And why would you want to send me away? And he's telling me I need to come back and give birth to my son. I don't want my son in that terrible place. He's here with me. He, you know, he can be here with me, and he never has to go through all of these things that you go through down there, and or wherever it was, Earth is. And he tells me that it's really important that this is something I want to do, and that this child will give me a lot of soul growth. And believe me, he has. And he tells me that he will be the son of my right hand, and because our family was a bit steeped in the Bible, that I knew what I could relate to that. That was Benjamin. And so, you know, he conveyed all of that to me. But I still wasn't coming back. And then there were other people there. There were people that I had never met on earth, and there were people that I knew and loved that had passed on. One of them was my grandmother, my very favorite grandmother, my brother. There was a baby sister that my brother was holding. Now, she was born before I was, but she was stillborn, so she never took a breath. And I reached out. I wanted to hold that baby. This is a baby I had heard about all my life. She was born before I was. She strangled during birth. It broke my mother's heart. And I wanted to hold that baby so much. I wanted to take her, and I'm reaching for her, and my grandmother put her arm out, and she said, no, this is my sweet grandmother, and she's no, and I said, I want to hold Jane Marie, and she said, no, and I said, but Ed's holding her, and she said, he belongs here, you don't. How could she say such a terrible thing to me? And, you know, I did not get to hold Jane Marie. There's something I want to tell you about distraction. In this dimension, on the earth plane, you know, if you are communicating with someone and there's a lot of people here that you really love and want to see and haven't seen for a long time, your focus would be a little bit split, probably. There, that love, that attention, tends to be focused so that you're more focused on the person you're communicating with. So it's not a distraction. It's an added help to your focusing, I guess I would have to say. I'm sure there's a better word. And so this was a wonderful time, and I thought I was just going to be there. I thought this was heaven, and that's it. It wasn't it. There were a lot more things that happened while I was on the other side. one of the things was that I don't know how I got from that place to this place in the light that I cannot begin to tell you what it looked like. There is no way for my organic mind to understand it. But there is this incredible presiding spirit, and there are all these other wondrous spirits. You may call them angels, call them whatever works for you, because there's no way to identify in the same sense that we call each other by name here. When we say a person's name here, it's like, okay, I'm going to pick on Sandy. You know, I can look at Sandy and I say, this is Sandy Cherry. Y'all have a picture in your mind of what Sandy looks like and sounds like and maybe even smells like. What you probably don't have is what she sounds like, what her symphony is. This beautiful, glorious being, that there is music to her identity, there is a fragrance to her identity, there is a feeling to her identity, way beyond anything that we have here. So when you're in that other dimension, you have all of that. We are all a symphony, and each of our symphonies are different. And if you go out on the across the world, it's the same thing. So I had that experience. I had this experience with this being in the light who is just this incredible, magnificent being. There are other spirits there, angels, whatever you want to call them. I can feel this love flowing through me, and it's like I am expanding with this love. This presiding being, it wasn't as if he was above the others. His place was held or made, whichever, by the honor that he gave to everything and everyone around him, and the honor that they gave back to him. It was like they gave this to him, but he was egoless, I guess is the best I can say. And then he asked me a question, and he asked me, how well have you lived your life? And it was a really expansive question. It wasn't like someone on this earth asking me how well I have lived my life. It included everything. There was no rationalization. There was nothing. I had this feeling of just wanting to fall at his feet. And I said, I have failed, Master. And he said, no, you have lived, my child. And then he called or summoned my life for me to see. Only it wasn't to see, it was to relive it. And as I relived it, I also lived every single thing as the person that I affected. And I lived their feelings. I lived the things that caused them to be as they were. There was this little boy in school when I was in grade school. Now, we were poor farmers. So everyone else was above me, I thought, because they had electricity and they could get to town or lived in town or whatever. And we lived way out in the country. 5 miles, but we were on a dead end. There was this little boy that the teacher used to grab him and make him sit up in his chair, and she used to say to him, sit up! Are you a fish bait? And so she kind of gave us permission to pick on him, and usually it was me being picked on because I wasn't stylish, and a lot of the kids in the school where I went, their parents were doctors and attorneys and teachers and professors and things. And I was a poor little farm girl. And my mother believed that your knees should never show, and you had to wear dresses in those days. So my dresses were below my knees, and that wasn't the style. So that there were a lot of reasons why I was picked on. I'm going to call this little boy Jared, because Jared wasn't a name in use back then, back where I come from. Anyway, so it's recess time, and Jared is being picked on. There's a circle of kids around him, right by the tree, and Jared's kind of curled up at the bottom of this tree in our schoolyard. We had a school field, and they're picking on him, and I went over, and I got to join in. You know, it's like, here's the kids that, you know, I'm rejected most of the time, and they're saying, come on, come on. And I got to join in. I got to see the things I said as a little bitty kid. I wasn't saying bad words, but it was pretty hurtful. You don't have to use bad words to hurt other children. And Jared's, after a bit, he's curled up at the base of the tree, and pretty soon Jared pees his pants. And I didn't feel sorry for Jared, not really, kind of, but, you know, I was happy to be part of the group for once. Well, when I got to relive that in my life review, I got to feel all of Jared's feelings. And, you know, Jared went home for lunch. He lived near the school. I thought he just had it made. He had a good-looking mama, and his daddy had a regular job. And you know what I got to find out when I was reliving Jared's life? I got to see that Jared went home at lunchtime, and quite often there wasn't any lunch for him. And so Jared was hungry. I got to see the abuse that went on in that family, and my heart just broke. I mean, there I am. And when you're on the other side and your heart breaks, there is nothing. There is no rationalization. You can't say, well, but I didn't know. That was one of the really painful experiences for me. I had a lot of good experiences during my life review also, but that one I just remember because I didn't know. And here's this little boy that I thought had life a lot better than I did. That life review went on and on and on. You know those long, lazy summer days that you had when you were a kid? You know, there was nothing, you know, to get in the way. You didn't have to go to school. It's kind of like that. It was very relaxed, and I got to get all of this learning from it. And then, when all of that was finished, once again, this wondrous spirit asked me about myself. How had I honored myself? How had I honored the divine spirit within me? I had never heard of a divine spirit in a person. I really hadn't. You know, I grew up in a farming community. There was the intellectual community, of course, but mostly I was part of the farming community, and we had, let's just say, our religious beliefs were quite fundamental. And that does not include any divinity in you, because part of the fundamentalism that I grew up with teaches that you're nothing. You are a black sinner. You're a black sinner from birth because Adam and Eve fell and they passed it on to you, and there's no divinity there. They also teach that you came into existence at the time that you were conceived. So there was no me prior to that. So there were a lot of things that started to, you know, my religious teachings and what was happening were two different things. They just didn't relate to each other. So here I am being asked, how have I honored that divinity, that divine light within myself, that peace of God? I had always been a peacemaker, and I thought that was wonderful. Isn't that what the Bible teaches? Blessed are the peacemakers, you know? And I got shown how that sometimes being a peacemaker is maybe not quite the way to go. Peace has got to have something to do with standing up for the right at times. I got to be shown the times in my life when I had been submissive when something was out of line, or I had not stood up for my children, or I had not stood up for someone else, or I had taken abuse that I should not have taken. And that was a big eye-opener for me. At the end of the time of the life review, I was feeling shattered. I was feeling, even with all of this love being flowed through me, I was feeling sad for my life and how I had lived it and what I hadn't understood. Once again, I don't know how they disappeared. They just weren't there anymore. And I was in the presence of this incredible divine mother personality. And there was no doubt in my mind that this was a divine mother. And she held me and she comforted me. And she showed me the perfection of me. Once again, another thing that didn't fit in with my religion. She showed me the perfect being that I am inside. And she also told me that that was true for every other human being. She showed me the perfection that I started out with. And that perfect soul lived within me. And I wanted to be like her. She had these wonderful, incredible attributes. She was not able to see anything except perfection. And I wanted to be like her. And she told me that I could learn to be like her, but to do it, I had to come back to this earth. When I was ready, I could call on her, and she would open a filament of myself in my heart, and she would teach me through it, and she would teach me to nurture, and she would teach me to love unconditionally, and she would teach me to understand the pain that I would cause even when I didn't know it, so that I would feel that pain. And she told me I would feel it very intensely. And I was very sad because I knew I wasn't coming back. I wanted to be like her, but I didn't want to come back to this to do it. That was okay. She didn't say you have to go back. She just told me that that's how I could achieve it. There were many, many things that I wanted to learn. And when I told this Divine Mother that I did not want to come back, at that point in time, I got new guides. Now, I don't know why I got new guides, but I got new guides. And I wanted to know about the past and about the future, and I wanted to know all kinds of things. You know, all my life I've just been very curious about everything. I got to see the past. I got to travel all the way back to the beginning before there was humanity. And I got to see all of those things. I got to see, okay, in my belief, you have heaven and you have hell, and hell you burn forever and ever and ever. And I didn't understand here, you know, I had been told that, you know, I was this terrible sinner and I was going to go to hell unless I became something wonderful, which my family didn't think I was. At least my birth family didn't. And so I wanted to know and understand about this, what this hell business was. It's the only time that I had a sense of walls, of being in, of an enclosure. I got to go and see these souls who were, I don't know how to express it. They were judging themselves. They were feeling horrible, whatever. There's no rationalization, and there's no way for that to... I understood it at that point in time. I just don't have good words. But they were shattering, and it was the angels there that were trying to help them come back to a place of rest, to try and to help them to deal with all these things. And you can call them sins, call them whatever you want. But it was a terrible place. And it was dark in the sense of that they were not giving off light. Every other being that I met was giving off light to some degree. Everything was light within light within light. But these beings were not giving off light. I've always been interested in prophecy, even as a child. You know, when I was 3 years old, I was sitting in on Bible studies and participating in Bible studies. And prophecy always fascinated me. When I went back from that point in time, which was 1975, back to the beginning, it was like a spiral. And I got to enter at any place I wanted and ask questions about it and all the whys and wherefores. And I had a lot of questions. I had a lot of questions about all of this. I got to see the answers to that. But when I wanted to see the future, it also was a spiral, but it was a different kind of spiral because there were possibilities. Each of those possibilities would go off in its own spiral. And so there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands, of uncountable possibilities, which did not sit well with me because I was, you know, I was always into prophecy and this is the way it's going to be. And I wanted to know the future, exactly how it was going to be. And I said, it's prophesied. You know, show me the prophecies. And that's when I learned this one little thing. Prophecy isn't something that's given to tell us what's going to happen. It's given to tell us what's going to happen if we don't change. And then I was shown, I'm here citing the Bible scriptures, which I can't now. And memory is perfect over there. Wish I had it now. In every one of those cases that I cited, my guides showed me why that prophecy was given. The one that I always go back to is Jonah. Jonah did not want to go to Nineveh, and he did not want to tell the people to change. And God told him what? He said, you've got to do it. And they had all these plague things, right? All these three things happened to him. You know the story. I'm not going to do the story. But the reason he didn't is because what did Jonah say? He said, if I go and tell them what's going to happen to them if they don't change, they're going to change, and you're not going to do these things. You're not going to crush them. And they deserve to be crushed. And that's not his exact words, but probably what we have recorded isn't his exact words either. And so I was just shown that. This is what prophecy is about, you know? And I was quite disappointed that I was wrong. But I also, it was a joyful thing to know that the world, we build the world. We build our world. We build our life. We have choices. I grew up being taught that we didn't have choices. We only had choices between right and wrong, but we didn't have big choices. And so that was an incredible thing for me. I want to tell you about seeing these spirits. I call them my spirits of purple lights. I had never heard of, when did indigo children, the term indigo children, come into being? I don't know. This is 1975, so I don't think it was coined at that point in time. There were these spirits that had not yet been born, and they were, to me, they had a purplish hue, and that's the best I can do with these eyes and with this terminology that I have. And there were, amongst them, there were spirits that were burdened. They had these gray burdens that kind of weighed them down, and they surrounded them. And I wanted to know about that. And I was told that they were the ancestors of the spirits that they were teaching. And they were trying to teach those children to be born, that were going to be born into their family lines, to resist what they had actually taught the parents of the children that those children would be born to. They were trying to change them, to help them to resist the teachings that they would receive. And there were just thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And I thought that was a pretty neat idea. You know, you teach these children that are going to come how to change the world, right? And so, but I thought, why? All these thousands of years, why had this never been done before? And I was told it had been done before. And those children were marginalized. They were persecuted. They were killed. They were ignored. They were... They didn't fit in, you know, what happens. And I got to see how that happened through history. It's amazing how one little question could bring something like that up. One little question and the whole world would open. But it was such an incredible thing. I got to see that they were actually connected. It wasn't just that maybe a child that was going to be born to me or to my line was being taught by someone maybe that was going to be, that had come from your line. I was shown that family connections were really important. Up until then, I can tell you right now, up until then, I did not have any belief that family was any more important than just people we love because we were born into that family. And I got to see how they're connected. We're connected all the way back and we're connected forward. I don't have a good way to express that. I had never heard of genealogy. When the old folks sat around talking about their old folks, I thought that was pretty boring. And now I'm being shown these connections that are really, really important. I didn't hear about genealogy, I don't think, maybe a year or two before I moved west. I came west in 79. So up until then, I had no knowledge of those things. I had no knowledge of pre-existence being believed in up until 1977, I think. And then I learned that there was a church that taught about pre-existence. I knew about reincarnation because I knew some of the Eastern things. You know, we joke around, well, you're going to come back as a cow or you're going to come back as an ant and I'm going to step on you. You know how kids joke around in high school. And so I knew that term, but pre-existence I had never heard of. I'm trying to think. I really want to tell you things that I didn't tell you the last time I spoke. I'm going to wrap this part of it up. I want to tell you what it was like coming back. coming back was terrible. I want to tell you, first of all, I want to tell you about my son. I really need to tell you a couple of things, but I'm only going to do them short. I met a soulmate. I met several soulmates, but I've met this one soulmate who just came. I mean, it was like the soulmate came flying to me. I'm saying, you didn't come. You did not come. You were supposed to come. And you didn't come and be with me. And that soulmate said, I will, but you won't know me at first. But then you will know me. It was just wonderful being with this person, with this spirit. And I knew that. I knew that person. I also knew when that person was conceived years later. I knew before the parents knew. I did get to meet future grandchildren over there. I guess I have to tell you how I finally decided to come back. That soulmate couldn't convince me to come back. And finally what happened is they brought my child that I was carrying to me. And he talked to me and he told me that I had promised to give birth to him before I was born. And that it was necessary that he be born, that he very much wanted to be born on this earth, that he had things to do. I finally realized that I really did want to give birth to him. And I wanted to give birth to him on this earth because that was what we had planned. When they brought him to me, I was standing in with a group of, well, the only thing I can call them is elders. They were spirits that they had something to do with record keeping or something. I don't really know or understand all that. But I did there. I understood everything there. And they are the ones who summoned him for me because no one could convince me to come back. They made promises to me. As I am agreeing to come back, now as I'm understanding, I am thinking something else. I am thinking, I have seen the future. I know about these things. I know about cause and effect. Okay, I can handle this because I can tell the world. And they're not going to do those things that are going to cause this awful future. They will, and there was a sorrow. And it was for two reasons. Number one, many people had tried to tell the world what made me think that anybody was going to listen to me. And it wasn't like a smart thing. It was a sorrowful thing. Nobody's going to listen. And the other thing was, there was no way for me to bring back all the knowledge. Not because it was being kept secret. Not because we aren't allowed. Once again, here we are with several reasons. Number one, once I left that dimension, my understanding would come down to what I could understand with this finite mind. There was no way to explain things. Number two, to be able to tell people everything that's going to happen takes away free choice. It would be stealing from me if they allowed me to bring all that knowledge of my future back. And that's true for everyone. That doesn't mean that you can't have dreams and you can't have premonitions and you can't have no pieces, but we still have to be free to act on those. And so I gained that knowledge, which was way far beyond anything that I could understand here on earth prior to that. I also was promised that if I came back and gave birth to this child, I could choose again at his birth. And I had seen what his birth would be. I knew that was the point at which I would be leaving. So I indicated that, okay, I would give birth and then I was coming straight back. And there was no judgment, there was no recrimination on any of the part of any of the elders. At that point, my dad was there. He was kind of part of that sender back committee. And my son was there. And there was no recrimination from any of them. So when I came back, I knew that I only had a few months and that I was going back. And I thought I could probably handle that. And then I came back into that hospital room. I'm hanging up in the corner and I'm looking down on that spoiled doe body and it is grayish white and it is dead and it is terrible. And there is no way I can bring myself to go back in that body. And as I'm hovering up in that corner, a different diet aid this time carried a tray in and told me my supper was there. There was no way I can go back in that body and do anything. I just can't. I had a roommate at the time, and she said, as this little gal was walking out of the room, she said to her, "Somebody better check her. She hasn't moved all afternoon. She did not eat her lunch. The last I talked to her was 9:30 or something this morning, and I can't get a response out of her." Now, Ellen and I were both had to stay in the bed or fear losing our lives or our children, our babies. So she was not able to come over and do anything. So this diet aide comes around the bed, and she looks at my face, and she throws her hands up over her mouth, and she goes running out of the room. And she runs to the nurse's station, and she says, "That lady in there is dead." Well, two nurses come running in. Well, you know what happens between lunch and dinner? In a hospital, they change shifts, and what are the nurses supposed to do, the first thing? They're supposed to take vitals, check all the patients, right? Lunch in that hospital, on that ward, comes at 11:30 in the morning. Dinner comes at 5. Dinner or supper, whichever you call it. Nobody had checked, and I was laying there in that bed, and as far as they were concerned, they put through a cuff on me. The other nurse is pushing my roommate's bed out of the way, and they're rushing me out the door, bed and all, and down the hall. There was no resuscitation equipment on the floor at that time. You know what they were thinking about? They weren't thinking about me. They were thinking about they were going to lose their jobs. They were going to lose their licenses. I'm dead, and the baby's dead, and they're accountable. I could hear their thoughts, and as they're rushing me down the hall to the elevator, I'm up here just kind of floating along, and the panic, I mean, it's a wonder the hallway didn't blow up. There is so much panic in them. We're standing there, they're standing there, one on either side of the bed, waiting for the elevator. You know what happens with elevators? You know, it dings before it arrives and the door opens. It says, "Come on, I'm here for you." That elevator dinged, and I knew in that instant that was choose now or it was over. And I went back in my body, and I started to breathe. They did this. This was the amazing thing. They went back to the room, and that's what they're running me down the hall, and I am in this horrible pain. Every cell in my body, I could have counted the cells in my body. I could have told you how many cells at that point were in my body. Everything hurt. I hurt. I was sick. And they didn't take me back to my room. They took me to another room. And they started hooking things up and all of this stuff. And I'm in misery. Everything there is foggy until the next morning. Before daylight, probably around 5:30, 6 o'clock. I don't know. All I know is they took me back to my room before the day shift came on. So there had to have been two shifts that knew. That, you know, thinking back over it, because the shift changes again at 11, unless they were working doubles. I don't know. All I know is they took me back to my room. My roommate said, "What happened to you?" At that point, I'm saying, "I don't know." And I'm wondering what she's asking about, because first of all, there's this huge experience in my head. And second of all, my memory from other things on this planet is just foggy. It's like I'm drugged or something. And that is how I came back to this world. It was really hard. If you can think of the most terrible time you've ever had in your life, the most depressing, the darkest, the worst place you've ever been, a coal mine, a whatever, where there's no light, that's what it was like in comparison. I had been where I had all knowledge of anything I thought about, and now I'm where I can't even think. Everything's heavy and ponderous. But I'm holding on to that promise. I only need to stay until that child is born. And I know I'm not strong enough to stay in this world. And so I was in the hospital another close to 2 weeks. I was in the hospital a total of 3 weeks total. And then I was at home with a nurse on bed rest. And I'm just waiting out my time. And I know what's going to happen. I've seen the birth of the child. I know I'm going to have a C-section. Never had a C-section before. I told my doctor. He says, "No, you're not going to have a C-section. There's no reason, da, da, da." I tell him a lot of things. And he's saying, no, "We were good friends. two families were. Anyway, when it came down to it, I ended up having the surgery. There's a whole story in that. When they brought that baby out, I came out of my body and I was leaving. They had to do a lot of other surgery. And I was leaving because he was born. And I had by then selected three different women for my husband to choose from as wife. Well, you can't go and get married as soon as your wife dies, especially if she dies in childbirth. So I told all our friends, you know, I told them that. And I told my obstetrician, I told him, you have to save this baby. That's, you've got to promise me you're going to save this baby if there's a choice to be made. And you have to not blame yourself if I don't make it. And he's saying, Bonnie, we do not lose mothers in childbirth in this day and age. And I said, well, you just have to promise me. And so they really thought I was quite far around the bend. Let's go to the operating room, and they've got my baby out. By the way, they had a whole neonatal team standing by. This kid was high risk, and he weighed almost 10 pounds. But they could not get a good amniocentesis on his lungs. So they were concerned as to how well this child would do. They had kept doing amniocentesis, and it's supposed to be a 2. Somebody maybe understands those numbers, and the highest they ever got on him was a 1.7. So the whole neonatal team is standing there. They did the incision, and before he made history in that hospital. It's a big hospital because he started wailing before he was officially born, as soon as his face was cleared. And so everybody cracked up, and all the tension was gone out of the room. And then I came out of my body, and I am going to leave. And this baby, I saw him. He was glorious. He was shining. He was beautiful. He had these beautiful blue eyes. He looked right at me. You've never seen such a beautiful baby in your whole life. He was incredible.
So he looked right at you?
He looked right at me.
Were you in your body?
No, I was out of my body.
You were in your spirit.
I had come out of my body. I'm leaving. And he looks right at me with those beautiful eyes, and I'm seeing this beautiful child, and now I can go because he's safe. He has cried. Everybody is just happy with this kid. And he looks at me and he says, don't leave me, Mom, I need you. And in that instant, all this time, all those 3 months, I had been looking for the very best mother for my child, for my children. And I realized something at that point in time, because I'm not the best mother in the world, never was, probably never will be. I realized that I was the very best mother for him, and he really did need me. And I went back into my body, and they did all these things to me. And so I had all this surgery, and then I'm back in my room, and of course I'm under the anesthetic. After I went back in my body, I was out. That was it. And I woke up in my room, and I'm feeling groggy, and I'm very, very ill. When I was able, I kept insisting they bring my baby to me, and I wasn't able to hold him. And they brought my baby to show him to me. And I looked at that baby, and he was the ugliest baby I've ever seen. He was so fat, he could not get his eyes open. He weighed almost 10 pounds. There was no way for me to even see that his eyes were blue. And he cried and cried. That's all he did. And I couldn't hold him. And the nurse held him down for me, and my feeling was, this is not my baby. This is not my baby. Now, you can't say that to a nurse in the hospital. They really, I mean, at this point in time, people are already thinking I'm a little just touched in the head. And so I said, are you sure that's my baby? And she said, yes, I'm sure. And I said, well, how do you know that's my baby? He doesn't look like my baby. And so she told me all of their safeguards. They footprint them. They do put a bracelet on them. They do all of this before they're bathed. Da 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 da. And I couldn't find any fault in any of that. So I had to accept that baby. And I'm sure that part of it had to do with being under the anesthetic. I'm sure part of it had to do with not being able to look in his eyes. But I couldn't relate to that baby. Not that baby and the baby that had talked to me in the operating room, it just did not fit. anyway, we were in the hospital for nine or ten days, and then I took him home, to a nurse, because I couldn't manage to hold him long enough to feed him even. It was a terrible time. I was very depressed. I'm here. I gave up my chance to leave. And now I've made a long-term decision, and I don't think I can live up to it. Second of all, prior to my NDE, prior to that near death, I had almost a photographic memory. And if anybody here has a photographic memory, you know that you think differently. You learn differently. Everything is different. My photographic memory was gone. My short-term memory was horrible. I mean, it was just, if I laid my baby down, I had to put a hand on him. You know how mothers lay the baby on the couch beside them when they're visiting with their friends? I could have just as easily gotten up and walked out and not known that I had walked out of the room and not known that I left him laying there. So I was very careful. But that's how my short-term memory was. And yet I had this memory of this incredible experience. All of it. How? And so I have this confusion. Number one, I still have an intellect. So it's like, you cannot be out of your body and gone. You can't be dead for 5 hours and come back and be alive. So that doesn't make sense. But you have this experience that you remember, and it's more real than anything you know of. It's so full and incredible. It just doesn't fit. And it took a long time for me to work with that. I also had something that I had had when I was a small child. I could see events before they happened. And I didn't see them like a moving picture. I saw them like I was living in them. I didn't understand any of that. I didn't understand. Fitting it all together just didn't work in this finite mind. And I couldn't find these short-term memories. And then I found out that I lost some long-term memories because I walked into a bank one day and the teller said, "Well, hello, Bonnie, how are you? I haven't seen you at all." I said, "You know me?" She said, "You don't know me?" And I said, "No. Should I?" And she said, "I used to come to your house and spend weekends with your niece, Janie." And it took a long time for me to sort that out and find it. What I realize now is the memory, all of our memories are out here. And this is just Bonnie speak. You don't need to accept any of this. But for me, this is what happened. I had to be able to get out here into the memory to find those things. And in learning to get out into that memory, that's where my short-term memory was also. I have no idea what you find if you x-ray my brain or you MRI it or whatever. I used to do math and algebra and geometry, trig, all of it in my head. I could not write a phone number down. If you gave me your phone number, you gave me it one digit at a time and you waited until I wrote that digit. If you gave me two at a time, everything scattered. And so I had all of this that I had to get back. And so having taught kindergarten for a while at a private school in Florida, I worked with some brain damaged children and we did brain patterning. And so that's what I did with me. I started with math and I worked up. And I kept working on a daily basis with the finding the memory out here and being able to go back and forth. My memory isn't too bad now. Back in 98, IANS had a conference here. And by then, when I was working in aerospace and I was doing a lot of things that have a lot of responsibility, I didn't talk about this. I didn't talk about it to my pastor, and I didn't talk about it to my friends because in a lot of fundamental religions, God doesn't talk to you. If you have a spiritual experience, it's probably Satan working to deceive you. And I had learned as a small child to keep my mouth shut about things that other people didn't agree with. So I hadn't talked about this until after I left my management jobs. And I just call it leaving corporate America. I ended up talking to people that were sometimes that were terminal and in a job that I had, I would come in contact with these people and sometimes I would be prompted to tell them a little bit about my experience. Well, one of my friends called me back in 98 and he said, "There are a whole bunch of people like you that are coming to a convention in Salt Lake this weekend." This was a Friday night. And he said, "You've got to go to it. They've had experiences in the light like you have." And I, yeah. And he said, now I want you to call him. Here's the phone number. 11 o'clock at night, Friday night. And so I promised him that I would call. 7:30 in the next morning, he called, or 7 I think it was, he called me and he said, did you make that phone call? And no, I'm going to do it right now. All right, I'm going to call you back in 10 minutes. You better have done it. So I called this phone number that Bill English is. Bill isn't here. Well, I called this phone number, and I'm going to tell you the ridiculous thing that Bill said to me. I said, one of my friends told me that there's some kind of convention, people that have had near-death experiences or something, experiences in the light. And he said, oh, yeah. And I said, well, would that be for someone like me? And he said, hey, it's for anybody that wants to come. And I said, well, will I have to talk or identify myself or anything? You know, I don't. And he said, you don't have to do anything. Come learn about it. I said, well, what is it like? And he said, it's like a big family reunion. And, you know, my brain says, yeah, right. A bunch of strangers get together and it's like a big family reunion. Ha, ha, ha. But I drove down to Salt Lake and I signed up. And when I wasn't working, I went to the meetings. And you know what? It was like a big family reunion because I wasn't different. There were people there that had strange things happen around them. There were people that couldn't wear watches because the watches speeded up. There were people that drained batteries in a minute and all kinds of things. There were people that had glorious experiences and nobody thought I was special and nobody thought I was weird. But there was this bond, this spiritual bond from heart to heart with us. And that's how I found Ions and that's how I ended up here. And I started to talk about my experience a little bit. But there was a person there named PMH Atwater. And PMH, I attended her lecture, and it was about, let's see if I can think of the title. Anyway, it was about the markers in children who have had infant, pre-verbal near-death experiences. And as she's going through this, you know, this whole field was new to me. And as she's talking about this, I had every one of those markers. When I was a child, I used to tell my family things that were going to happen. And we're on a dead-end farm, and we don't have a phone. No TV. We didn't have electricity, so no TV. Once in a while, the radio, when we could afford a battery. But it was usually only turned on for the news. But I would tell my family something that was going to happen. And when I saw it, it was like I was living in that time and this time. And it wasn't confusing to me. And I thought that everybody was like that. And I had no idea why I was getting whooped. And I was getting whooped and called a little liar. And I had no idea why. And so PMH threw some light on that day. One day, I was out playing on the bank behind the house. And, you know, back east, we have a lot of shale. And instead of dirt roads, there's shale roads. And you know what shale does? It crackles when you drive over it. Our road was carved out of the side of the mountain through the trees, and it was just exactly one car width wide. And my uncle always drove it very slowly because a couple times he went over the bank. We had to get the tractor or the horse and pull him out, depending on which we had at the time. I heard the shale crackling under the tires, and I looked up, and coming down the lane is my Uncle Cliff and my Aunt Betts, and they didn't have any children. But Aunt Betts has on my very favorite dress, and it was a dark color with flowers all over it. Sitting in that car with her little legs sticking straight out was my cousin, who was just 3 weeks older than I am. And this is great because Aunt Betts and Uncle Cliff had to have gone to town to have gotten her and then to bring her. And so I'm going to have someone to play with that's not family, you know. So I run in the house and I say, Mom, Mommy, Aunt Betts and Uncle Cliff are coming. Aunt Betts has on my favorite dress. And they have little Isabel with them. And then I go out to play because I know it's going to happen. And my mother, she's straightening up the house. My Aunt Betts didn't have kids. Her house was always straight and clean. Ours wasn't. And after a while, she comes out. They haven't come driving in and up and around and park where everybody parks. And I'm just playing out in the grass on the bank up there, and she yells at me. And she comes and gets me, and she said, you told me, da-da-da. Anyway, she gets me, and she drags me in the house, and she calls me and tells me I'm a little liar, and she's got to beat the devil out of me because children aren't supposed to lie to their mothers. And so she whoops me. I am there sobbing my heart out, I don't like being looked. Here comes the car. Uncle Cliff and Aunt Betts and little Isabel and everything is just the way I described it. And I'm still crying from the whooping, so it couldn't have been more than 10 or 15 minutes. Now I get sent in the other room. It's summertime. I want to play. Everybody is out there having fun and talking and visiting, and Isabel's playing with my sisters, who are 14 months younger than I am. They're twins. I'm in the other room crying. And my brother, who is 6 or 7 years older than I am, comes in, and this is the same brother that passed away that I met on the other side. He comes sneaking in, because when you're whooped and you're crying, nobody's supposed to come and talk to you. And he says, "How do you always know what's going to happen before it happens?" And I am so shocked, I quit crying. And I said, "Well, you know too." And he said, "No, I don't." I said, "Yes, you do. You know everything that's going to happen." And he says, "That's not true. Besides, if that were true, my teachers would have told me. Besides, no 5-year-old could know that." And that's the day that I learned to shift. I learned to figure out whether something was going to happen or something was happening. I never got whooped for telling lies again. So that connected up. And that's the first I knew that everybody wasn't like that. That connected up. PMH Atwater's talk connected that up for me. She told me to write about it. I don't remember. I knew that I smothered at 8.5 months. I knew that my dad had revived me somehow. I knew that I had screamed and squalled for 8.5 months because my family talked about it. Worst case of colic anybody had ever seen. My dad would walk the floor with me at night, and my mother put up with me during the day. And also, the talk of the family was, in 3 weeks, I was walking, talking, and potty trained after that smothering. So I do not remember that as a near-death experience, but apparently I had a near-death experience because those kinds of things just don't happen. My mother thought it was great because when I was 14 months old, she had twins, and there would have been a lot of diapers.
Can you say a little more about the purple spirits?
A little more about the purple spirits. What do you want to know about the purple spirits?
What exactly is their purpose here? Is it simply to resist the old teachings? And
to teach us. It's to resist the old teachings and to teach us. It's also to teach us to honor, to teach us peace, to teach us love. They know so much more than we do.
Are these the kids that are getting medicated because they're not like other kids?
I believe that a lot of them are, yes. I believe a lot of our, what people would call indigo children now, that people here talk about and write about, I believe that a lot of those kids are being medicated because they don't fit in. You know, they know how to focus. These kids know how to focus, and we don't let them focus. We put them in front of a TV, or we put them in school, and we change gears on them every 10 minutes, and they have to all be the same. And that's not what these kids need. These kids need to be honored for who they are. I think that there are many, many people in this state that are doing that. I think that our system does not. And I think that these children come to change us and to change the system. And they're not just coming here. They're coming all over the world.
So is it working this time?
Is it working this time? Well, look at what has happened just worldwide, but also in our country. Just look in the past year. Is it working? Are we more peaceful? Do we make choices? Do we make decisions because it's the loving thing to do? Or do we as a society make a decision because we're scared?
My question was, like you said, something about resist the old teachings. I was just curious, does that refer to from your understanding, like Christianity or...
Okay, I want to answer your question with two things, okay? Resisting the old teachings has to do with right and wrong. It has to do with love or hate. It has to do with love and indifference, okay? Number two, I will not discuss religion. I want to make this statement, okay? The right religion for everyone is the, and this I learned on the other side, I didn't believe it prior to going to the other side. The right religion is the religion that brings you closest to God. And if you look at whatever your scriptures are, I don't care if it's the Bible, I don't care what the scriptures are, the scriptures that describe the attributes of God, if you look at those, you can see what is right and what is wrong, what is a good way to be and what is not a good way to be. The religion that takes you to being the closest to those attributes is the right religion for each person. That's really all I will discuss about religion, because if you follow me, you're not looking at your own light inside, and you're not following that divine part of you, and you're not connecting with that light. So I can't tell you what, I have to tell you to look within yourself. Whatever you call prayer, that you do that thing, and you know when you're on the right track. Because that's a promise. That's a promise from above. If you want to call it God, if you want to call it Holy Spirit, if you want to call it Allah, whatever, you know, that's the best I can do.
Thanks, Bonnie. Great talk. Are you aware of Howard Storms, what he was told on that question about religion?
Yeah, why don't you tell us?
Because it sounds so familiar. Howard Storm, who we spoke about in the beginning, an atheist when he went in and a total believer when he came out, he asked about, well, what religion, what's with all these different religions, which one should we go to or what have you? Kind of sounds like a Joseph Smith question, too. Anyway, his answer was very similar to what he said. There are good people in bad religions and bad people in good religions. It's not so much the religion that's important, but what people are doing with their lives, whether they're drawing close to God. I'm fumbling at the end there. But they refuse to give a specific direction, almost as if it would impair one's choice in that area. And it's much more open-minded than a lot of us are prone to think when we're religious in this world.
Right.
Did you know that he shared that, of course?
Yeah. I'm aware of that. I'm also aware that probably 90% of the people who come back from a near-death experience come back with that exact same message. Because those of us who have asked about, you know, what church should I join? What church, am I in the right one? Probably when I've gone to conferences, the retreat that I just went to, which was all experiencers, they're almost invariably, they are told, doesn't have to do with the religion. The religion is set up by man, and it's organized to help people become closer to God. But when it comes right down to it, where you belong is where you work to have those attributes. You ask about Howard Storm. He endorsed my book. When he was here last time, I gave him a copy of the little yellow book. So when I called him and told him what I was doing, and I said, would you endorse this? And he did. So his endorsement's on the back of the book.
When you had your life review,
uh-huh.
Was there a point that you knew you had forgiven someone, or you had repented of a problem, or however you want to state it? Was that in your life review, or had that experience gone away?
It had not gone away. What had gone away was the pain. So when I had my life review, those things that I had made right with a person, I got to see it, but I got to see the result of making it right, and there was no pain for me. There was only the joy that I had brought. In many cases, during that life review, when I had done something loving and kind and compassionate, there was joy, tremendous joy. And I got to see out people that I had never met, I got to see that result. But I got to see the result all the way out when I had not been compassionate also.
Bonnie, I just wanted to ask you two quick questions. First, how old is Benjamin? And the second question had to do with something you had said, that the things that we do in this life actually define what our spirit looks like in the next. Is that correct?
Yes. And I don't know if looks like is a good term, but the things that we do in this life earn us the body that we will have when we leave here, that we will go into. I will not go into the same body. My body will be different. Now, that doesn't mean it might not look the same, but it will have somehow have different or more attributes when I go this time, unless I was doing terrible things, and then it would have less. But the body that we get on the other side is a body we have earned.
I wanted to ask you a quick question. I may have missed this. Did you say anything about that you learned anything about reincarnation on the other side?
I didn't. And I don't know how to address that, to be quite truthful with you, because that reincarnation and the connectedness that we have to our ancestors is somehow intertwined. So if you ask me if I've lived on this earth before, I don't know. Have I had past life experiences? I've had several spontaneous past life experiences. I do not know if that means that I lived those lives or that I am just so sensitive that I tuned into a life that someone else lived. So I don't really have a good answer for you on reincarnation.
Mommy, can I just say that in all my research, and I don't know about the other people on the board, I've never run into anyone who, in their near-death experience, is shown that they've lived before. So, and yet many in the years will say that they have a feeling or they believe in reincarnation, but actually within the near-death experience, I've not run across anyone. I don't know if you have. So I'll pass this down.
I've had it explained that the reason people sometimes go to a place and it seems very familiar, they meet someone who's very familiar, or any circumstance that rings a bell in their mind. I've had it explained by some who return to the other side, that is because they themselves are guardian angels to people they know on earth. And so, of course, when they come to these experiences or these places or they meet people, it rings a bell. And that seems very logical to me. And as has been said, no one's ever come back and said, I know for sure I've lived another earth life. And also, I'd like to ask the question, Dick, have you had any extra gifts given to you since you returned that you didn't have before or that have been enhanced?
I had healing in my hands, but I had that as a child. I had family relatives and people that used to come and ask me to rub their rheumatiz, the knees and things like that. I never thought too much about it. I had healing things that have happened when I've worked on people just running energy. And I call it running energy. I didn't have good terminology. Sometimes I know things before they happen. Sometimes I see things about people's lives. I've worked very, very hard not to have the psychic gifts. There was a period of time when it was very difficult to be around people because I would feel things and they weren't my things, but they would come into me. And it doesn't mean that they were all negative. It's just very difficult to feel. It's like being battered when you have a lot of them. I worked very hard to shield that. But sometimes things just spontaneously come out for someone, and I don't really want to be a psychic because I don't want people to follow me. I'm nobody special. I will tell you this. I do have a connectedness to spirit. Anyone who takes the time and spends the time in contemplative, whatever you want to call it, prayer, meditation, whatever, you can be connected, more connected than you are. You can open that channel. So I'm not special. Anything that I can do, there's not a person in this room that can't do it. I think that the NDE, the near-death experience, is important for two reasons, for several reasons. Number one is our earth, our world, Mother Earth is crying out and she is shaking herself and there are things we can do. You know, the last thing I heard when I was coming back was honor my creation. Honor all my children. And I think it's important. I think that's what the message of the NDE is. The other thing is, I can guarantee you, there are people in this room who will have a near-death experience. Many people are confused and scared. I believe that the reason my near-death experience was so deep, and I have the memory of it, and I learned things, so many things, is because I had a near-death experience before. I believe that it's important for people to learn about NDEs because some of you are going to have NDEs. I think that you can have a wonderful, wonderful experience, and you can bring back many, many things if you decide to come back. That's hard to decide to come back.
One last question.
I have a very easy question for you. I've been to a lot of these meetings, and nearly everyone that has professed to have a near-death experience has talked about the other side. Where is the other side?
I'm not sure, this is the only way I know to answer that question, about where is the other side. I believe it's as close as reaching out here, but I don't know because it's so multidimensional. We see three dimensions. We sometimes feel our loved ones who have departed very close to us. Does that mean that they've left the other side and come here? Or does that mean that the other side is right here? I don't know. I don't know how far I travel. I haven't the faintest idea. I know I left this dimension for about 5 hours. The best I can do with that one, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I want to thank all of you for coming.